Truth Ministry defends the Christian faith, uncovers end times prophecies, and digs deeper into God's holy word. Find out more by going to www.truthministries.tv and be sure to listen to What is Truth, a Truth Ministries radio show every Sunday at 6 p.m. right here on AM 1300, Faith Community Radio, WIMO.
The opinions expressed in the following program are the responsibility of the program's producers. The staff and management of WIMO or its parent corporation, Country Road Productions, are not responsible for its content.
We all must search. We must search for what is truth.
What is truth?
Truth is...
Truth is just... that's a really hard question. What is truth?
There has to be a fixed truth, in my opinion, for the universe to function properly.
What is truth?
And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
And the truth shall set you free!
Hey, this is Dave Glander, host of What is Truth? Have you ever been faced with a question about your faith that you couldn't answer? 1 Peter 3:15 says, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. Tune into my show, What is Truth, where we interview world-renowned experts and answer the toughest questions facing our faith. What is Truth? Every Sunday at 6 p.m. on your Faith Community Network, WIMO.
Go.
Hey, welcome to What is Truth? This is your host, Dave Glander. I'm going to jump right into our show today because we've got a topic that can really be covered in about five or six shows. I mean, this is we're going to fly through a lot of information today. My special guest is Barry Schwartz, who is I'm going to actually ask him about some of his background instead of giving it to you. But Barry Schwartz has become a friend of mine as I've gone on my study for the Shroud of Turin to try and figure out the validity of it. Barry, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Dave, for having me.
Oh, it is just my pleasure, Barry, my pleasure. Let me go ahead and give out the number to the show, so that way if you have any questions during the duration of this, you can go ahead and call in. That phone number is 678-963-5482. That's 678-963-5482. You can also go online to Facebook and hit the What is Truth radio show with Dave Glander. Hit the like button there, and you can go ahead and submit your questions on there. We've got Shannon McDaniel, who is standing here in the background, monitoring that site, and you can go ahead and submit your questions there. So either way, Barry, let me start off by asking you first, what is your unique position within the Shroud as far as what makes you such a world-renowned expert?
Well, perhaps it's the fact that I was on the scientific team in 1978 that was the first ever in the history of the Shroud to be given the opportunity to spend 5 days and nights, 24 hours a day over that period of time, to perform the first in-depth examination of the cloth and its history. And so because of that, by default, there aren't many of us around anymore that can make the claim that we spent 5 days and nights in the room with the Shroud of Turin.
Yeah.
So I guess that's part of it. The other part of it is the fact that in 1996, I built Shroud.com, which is the oldest and largest website on the topic of the Shroud of Turin on the Internet. And so that coupled with doing radio shows like this one and appearing in many TV documentaries on the subject. So I guess I have achieved some notoriety, although I always tell people, I'm not famous, the Shroud is, I'm associated with it, so I gained some notoriety. But I'll be gone and forgotten, and the Shroud will still be here puzzling us.
I was going to say, you're a very humble person because, Barry, in your own right, you are a very – if anyone says the Shroud of Turin, the name is synonymous. Barry Schwartz goes right along with that. Barry, I want to before we go into what I'd consider to be the hard evidences for the Shroud and why you've spent a – really, you could say almost – a lifetime.
Half
of your life researching, presenting, as you said, going on TV shows, traveling the world, teaching on this. Barry, could you tell us, because I think it's of great significance, what is your current religious affiliation?
My current affiliation is the same as it's been since birth. I was born and raised in the Orthodox Jewish tradition. My parents were both born in Eastern Europe in Poland, and I was raised in a home very much like Fiddler on the Roof.
That's awesome. Don't you wish life was still like that in some ways? I really do.
True.
We have complicated things.
I might also add, so that I'm very clear about this, although that I am absolutely convinced of the authenticity of the shroud as the cloth that wrapped Jesus after he was taken from the cross and placed in the tomb, I am not a Messianic Jew. So that's much to the disappointment of some of my Christian evangelical friends particularly.
Yes.
But look, I could easily make those claims and know that my audiences might like that even more. But the whole purpose of my involvement with the Shroud really has always been to give access to the truth so that my Christian brothers and sisters and anyone else interested can get clear, unbiased, without any spin, information about this object. And based on that, they have to decide what it means for themselves.
Yes.
I don't try and tell people what to believe. It's not my place. I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a minister or a priest. And what's most important is that people to whom this might be of interest can study it. They can make their own minds up. And it says so on shroud.com. From the first day, it said, given the facts, we believe you should make up your own mind about this.
So just so we're clear, because I found this one of the most fascinating things about talking with you is, given the fact that you're not a Christian, you really don't have some agenda. I have been blamed when I go out and make a presentation on the Shroud that I have some agenda I'm trying to push, that I'm trying to get people saved, and that's why I'm presenting this Shroud of Turin as the authentic burial shroud of Jesus. With you, nobody can say that, Barry.
I don't have a horse in the race.
That's a very good way to look at it. And yep. One other thing that I find most interesting is you don't use anything that's not scientifically peer-reviewed. Meaning, could you go just a little bit into that before we go into the evidence you're going to share?
Sure. And let me explain why it's that way. Look, in the modern world that we live in, there's nothing that's perfect. But in the scientific area, the method used that is accepted worldwide as a basis for scientific fact is the process known as peer review. That is where the work is written up and presented to a journal of, depending on which specialty the article is written in, whether it be chemistry or physics or whatever else. And that journal then submits that paper to their board of peer reviewers that are experts in the same discipline so that they can review the work, they can make sure everything's right, they can send the paper back and ask for revisions, additions, changes, redoing of experiments, doing new experiments. And ultimately, if the paper passes through the peer review process and is accepted, then it's published in the journal. Now, that's the way science operates.
Absolutely.
It does not operate on blogs or websites or TV documentaries or commercial books. And so we, on our website, try and focus on those pieces of evidence that have withstood the scrutiny of peer review, because what that does is it adds veracity and validity
Absolutely.
To the claims that might be made from the conclusions drawn by those papers.
That's why I've been so fascinated in talking with you, is because of the fact that you don't allow some of these outside ideas to infiltrate your own study, your own research, and your own presentation. You only go with what can be backed up, tested, and validated in a correct scientific method. Barry, let's go ahead and address something that's just right out of the gate. Let's hit this, because in talking to people about the Shroud, most people don't even know what it is. And if you're that person, let me just go ahead and clarify what this is: the proposed burial cloth of Jesus of Nazareth. When his body was wrapped and put in the tomb, this is the cloth that people are proposing that was that he was wrapped in. The second most common thing I get is, didn't the 1988 carbon dating test render it just a medieval forgery? Can you address that for us?
Sure, I can. It's true that in 1988, a radiocarbon dating was permitted on samples taken from the Shroud. The protocol that was used was developed by seven different radiocarbon laboratories from around the world. They came together in Turin and over a period of a week developed a protocol upon which they would base this series of tests. The original protocol called for seven laboratories to do the testing. And the original plan was to take multiple samples from the shroud, because any scientific test, if it's based on a single sample, it's very difficult to claim any kind of percentage of certainty because you've only tested one little area. And this is a huge cloth that's been handled, been damaged by fire, been repaired more than once. So there's a lot that's happened to this cloth. And if you only use a single sample, you're risking that that sample might not be representative. If you have something to compare it to elsewhere on the cloth, mm-hmm. you can make more solid claims based on multiple tests of different areas. The problem was, the fear was of damaging too much of the cloth, and before the protocol meeting ended, they had already decided on a single sample site, which many people were unhappy with. After the protocol was accepted and approved, and even approved by the Pope at the time, some months later, and just before the actual radiocarbon dating occurred, they announced that only three laboratories would then be given this opportunity instead of seven. Perhaps because they were fearful of how much material had to be cut, I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
But the sadness is this, that when that protocol was changed so dramatically from seven to four, or to three rather, even the three remaining laboratories complained in writing, both to the Pope and to the Turin authorities, and one of them, the AMS radiocarbon dating inventor, Dr. Harry Gove, wrote openly to the Pope that if the protocol remained changed, the results would forever be in doubt.
Uh-huh.
And yet, at the end, only a single sample was allowed. Only three labs did the testing. They were hundreds of years apart in their findings. Some of their results were so far off the track that they threw them out as outliers, they're uh-huh. called. And the result was that they claimed with a 95% certainty that their date was correct, and they dated the shroud between 1260 and 1390.
Okay.
Well, those of us who'd been studying the shroud were well aware of evidence in the historic record that indicated otherwise. And probably the best and most prime piece of evidence in that respect was something called the Hungarian Prey Codex, or Prey Manuscript.
Yes.
It's an illuminated Hungarian manuscript, accurately dated. It was, you know, well documented, 1190, 1191.
Uh-huh.
On this illuminated manuscript is an illustration probably done by a monk sitting in a cell somewhere in a monastery. And it illustrated a crucified Jesus laid out on a herringbone weave cloth, arms crossed across his groin, nude, which Christian art, if you look at Christian art going back to the earliest days, Jesus has always been depicted with a modesty cloth
yes.
of some sort.
Yeah.
And yet, this illuminated manuscript broke all those traditions and showed a nude Jesus. And, of course, we know the man on the shroud is nude. And more than anything else, I guess the biggest clue that's in there are many burn marks on the shroud. It was heavily damaged in a fire in 1532. However, there were a set of burn marks on the shroud that predate that fire, and we call them the L-shaped burn holes, and there's a set of four of them. The shroud was obviously folded in quarters when they were burned into the cloth. And those L-shaped burn holes, we know they were there before the fire because a copy of the shroud made legitimately by an artist in 1516 illustrated those L-shaped burn holes.
Uh-huh.
So we know they were there before the big fire that did the
yes,
obvious damage
yeah.
we see today. And interestingly enough, this monk, whoever he was, had obviously seen the shroud. He included one of those L-shaped burn hole sets in his illustration.
Wow.
What else could it be if he hadn't seen the shroud? And remember this, prior to 1532, if you looked at the Shroud of Turin, you know, the image itself is only 10% darker than the background, so the image is subtle. So the first thing you would have noticed in looking at the Shroud of Turin prior to 1532 are these L-shaped burn holes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So why did he include them? Because they were there, he saw them, and he made them part of his illustration.
And the herringbone pattern is...
The herringbone pattern is illustrated as well.
And why is that important? That's a first-century weaving technique?
That happens to be the kind of weave that the Shroud is made of.
Okay.
That was not typical of an inexpensive burial shroud, but of an expensive one.
Okay.
But it's important to note that the Old Testament and the Torah, it clearly specifies that people of high stature, the Pharisees, someone in Jesus' position, for example, must be buried in pure linen raiments.
Okay.
And that means it couldn't be any what they call mixing of the kinds. You couldn't mix wool or cotton with it. Had to be pure. Now, other people of perhaps lower stature in the social stratus could be buried in wool or in cotton, but the idea was never to mix the kinds. And people of high stature had to be buried in pure linen. When my father died in 2003, he had an Orthodox Jewish burial. He was buried in a white linen, pure linen shroud. The only difference was, instead of being wrapped over his head and back down to his feet as the man of the shroud was, this was already sewn on the side so the body could in effect be slid in like a sack, if you will, and then wrapped over his head. And the reason I bring that up is often skeptics on the shroud tell me that, well, you know, it says in the Gospels the man was wrapped with strips of linen like a mummy.
Yeah.
Well, it does say strips of linen in the Gospel.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing. If you wrap the shroud over the body the way the shroud would have been wrapped, with the feet at one end, the head in the center, and then the cloth wrapped over the head and back down to the feet, if you try to move the body, it's just going to fall, the cloth's going to fall off. So they wrapped strips of linen around the neck and the waist and the feet so that it would bind the body within the shroud.
Okay.
And so the Gospels are exactly right that strips of linen were used, but not to wrap the entire body, but to bind the body into the shroud.
Not like the Egyptian mummy.
Not like an Egyptian mummy, no. This was not the way Jewish burials were done then or now.
Let's back up to the Prey manuscript. So if I hear you right, what you're saying is the carbon dating that pushes it back into to, you know, as early as the mid 1200s, we actually have a piece of artwork depicted in the Hungarian Prey manuscript that depicts very accurately the shroud represented, which especially with the herringbone pattern, the crossed arms, the naked body, the four burn holes.
That's correct.
You're saying is there's evidence within artwork that says that is diametrically opposed to the dating of the carbon dating.
Right, and those of us who knew that were puzzled at how they could come up with a date of no earlier than 1260 when we had solid historic evidence that it obviously existed at least 70 years earlier. And of course, there are other clues in the historic record to this cloth or cloths bearing the image of Jesus that probably are the same cloth. That, of course, is difficult to prove because there are gaps in the history, and of course, the skeptics use those gaps to say, ah, it's a fake.
Yeah.
But, you know, the carbon dating itself was a puzzlement. And for almost, 18 years or so, we went on and on with every theory presented of why the carbon dating was wrong and it was flawed. But, you know, in the end, it turned out to be that there was nothing wrong with the carbon dating at all. Only thing wrong was where they took the sample from.
Clarify that for us.
Sure. They took the sample from an area of the cloth that had been rewoven, more recent linen and cotton sewn into that area, because cotton is easier to dye than linen, so they could match the color of the repair to the rest of the cloth. In 2000, a couple from the U.S., Joe Marino and Sue Benford had done some research, had taken photographs of the radiocarbon dating samples to textile experts here in America. Those textile experts, and they weren't looking for anything anomalous, they were just showing them to try and get any feedback from these textile experts. And the first one looked at it and looked at the photographs and identified it as an old herringbone weave. They understood that this was quite old, perhaps even ancient. They did not know these photos were of the shroud samples. They were blind studied that way. And each of the three textile experts these were taken to, each reported the same thing. They said, oh, look over here. You can see there's been some manipulation and reweaving done by someone who knew how to do it very well. But that reweaving is evident to a trained eye. And so when they heard this from the first textile expert, Benford Marino said, well, you know, they weren't looking for that. That wasn't what they were interested in. So they took the photos to another textile expert and then to a third, and they got the same response from each textile expert. There's evidence that this has been manipulated and rewoven here by somebody who was very good at it and knew what they were doing. Well, Benford Marino were kind of curious about this, and they said, well, what kind of weaving could be done that would be so undisputed undetectable as to not be visible to those choosing that site for a sample site. And they found out that in about the 1500s at the French court, they perfected a technique called, to this day, French invisible reweaving.
Wow.
And it was pioneered because they had tapestries that had illustrations on both sides. So when they rewove them, you know, if you get something rewoven, you burn a hole in your trousers, you can get it rewoven, and the outside looks perfect, the backside looks terrible, because it doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this case, it had to be perfect on both sides, so they perfected French invisible reweaving.
How about that? How about
Ironically,
that?
The Turin authorities, when this theory was first presented, said, no such reweaving even exists. This is just made up. Until in Paris, one of my friends found a book called The Fenway System of French Invisible Reweaving. It was a book written in the 50s trying to preserve what was a dying art form.
Gotcha.
And it was obvious that whoever could do this had to be trained carefully. Here's the thing. The Shroud was in France at that moment in its history, and the French court had perfected this. What better object to use this technique on than the purported burial Shroud of Jesus?
Absolutely.
So they did it. Now, it was undocumented. It was done probably because, if you look at where the sample was taken, just adjoining that area, was a piece cut out by the Savoy family that was cut up and used for relics.
Uh-huh.
Well, when you cut into a woven cloth, especially this kind of weave, it starts to unravel. You have to reweave it and seam it again. And that's what we found in that corner of the Shroud, based on the work of Benford Marino. Now, when I heard them present their paper in 2000, I was just blown away, because it was the first answer to the radiocarbon that didn't ask me to accept either a miraculous intervention or some form of science yet to be discovered,
yeah,
none of which really can be used validly in the scientific world. And so when their paper came out, I was so enamored with it that I was there at the conference, and I went right up after they finished and said, look, that's spectacular. That's the first plausible thing I've heard in years. Can I reprint this on Shroud.com? And they said, yes, of course. So I printed it on, reprinted it on Shroud.com. And within, I don't know, a day or two, I got a phone call from Ray Rogers, the chemist that was head of our chemistry division on our team, from Los Alamos National Laboratories. No slouch, a real hardcore, top-of-the-line chemist, one of the top guys in the world in his field. Rogers was angry with me, and of course, we're on the radio, so I can't very well tell you exactly what he said, but he basically said, what kind of stuff are you publishing on your website? And I kind of said, relax, Ray. I said, have you read the paper? It seems that this is quite valid. They follow the scientific method. And he reminded me, look, these are the lunatic fringe. They're not scientists. Why would you put that on your site? And I said, better read the paper, Ray. And he said, look, I have samples left over from 78 in my safe. I'm going to unlock them. I'm going to take those samples out. Give me 5 minutes, and I'm going to prove they're wrong.
Yeah.
Well, about an hour and a half later, the phone rang, and it was Rogers, and he was no longer yelling at me. He was much quieter. And I said, well, what did you find? And he said, well, he says, I can't believe it, but I think they're right. In the end, as Rogers examined his materials, he found evidence not only of reweaving, he found an end-to-end splice. He found cotton interwoven with the linen. He found gum arabic that had been used to apply to the surface of those fibers that had been rewoven with a madder root dye inside the gum to sort of be the binder to hold that dye. And somebody had retouched the shroud after it was rewoven. We know it was done after the reweave, because if you remove some of the woven fibers, the top fibers, underneath there's no dye, meaning that it was done after the reweaving.
So in order to move on to some of the other evidences, what I hear you saying is this. The 1988 carbon dating testing has been rendered inadmissible over and over and over again. I mean, this is something that you don't hear very often when you're looking through the articles about it. You don't hear the depth in what you're actually covering this, that this isn't something that was just turned over loosely.
There's
plenty of supporting evidence to actually turn over the carbon dating. Not to say that the carbon dating was incorrect, but that it was taken from an area of the cloth that really was not a good
representation.
Absolutely.
I want to add to this. Rogers, understanding that the samples he had in his safe weren't exactly from the radiocarbon sample area, but from immediately adjoining it, requested and received actual parts of the sample that weren't used in the dating, so they were from that exact area. He did the testing on that and found exactly the same thing. And so then he wrote a paper that was published in one of the finest chemistry journals in the entire world, Thermochemica Acta, well, which you can find available on Trout.com. Yeah. And that particular piece of work was the first peer-reviewed science that challenged the results of the radiocarbon dating. Benford Marino, a few years later, after Rogers had passed away, published another paper in another peer-reviewed journal called Chemistry Today that further corroborated their findings and those of Ray Rogers. And so now even the media are starting to come around and say, well, they found that it was a medieval dating in 1988, but newer evidence has shown that the sample they used didn't represent the main body of the shroud cloth, so the radiocarbon dating is no longer valid. The 88 dating is set aside.
Absolutely.
Of course,
they'll latch on to anything.
Yeah.
Has there ever been any other testing, radiocarbon testing, that was done on it? I heard from Gary Habermas say one time that in 1982 there was actually a separate independent test that was run and came up with a first century date, but I've never really been able to qualify that.
The reason you can't qualify it is that Ray Rogers had loaned some of his materials to Al Adler, a blood chemist on our team, another Jewish man, by the way. By the way, the man who proved the blood on the shroud is actually blood. He is actually was one of the most world-renowned blood chemists.
Wow.
And what happened was this. Rogers had given Adler some samples. Adler sent one of those samples over to a friend of his at Caltech in California. Caltech doesn't have the right kind of equipment for that kind of dating, so our guess is Caltech sent the sample up to Lawrence Livermore that did have that kind of testing.
Uh-huh.
But because it was an unauthorized sample, Rogers had promised Turin he would never allow his samples used for carbon dating. And because Adler did it, he was very angry with Adler.
I gotcha.
And the man over at Caltech, when he was spoken to on the phone by Benford Marino, said, look, yes, it was done, and I'm going to tell you in a moment what was found. But he said, look, because it wasn't authorized, I will deny it forever, and he hung up on him. He didn't want to even talk about it. Here's what they found. It was one long thread. They carbon dated it and got one date at one end and a completely different date at the other. I don't know if they examined it carefully enough to see if there was a splice there or not.
Yeah.
But the point is, that test was never published in any journal, so it really doesn't exist in the world of science, and that's why we don't talk about it much.
I gotcha. What was the test date that they got, just for curiosity?
What they got was 900 years difference between each end of the fiber.
Wow.
So, automatically. And if you go back and look at what the archaeologist Bill Meacham wrote in 1986, which, by the way, is also on our website, you can read the paper he wrote because he had dated many Chinese linens. He's down in Hong Kong, and he had had lots of hands-on experience and found out that things like repairs, reweaves, contamination all skewed the carbon dates of those samples, and he cautioned that that could happen on the shroud. When that protocol meeting was held, Bill Meacham attended. He went all the way from Hong Kong to Italy, and they wouldn't let him speak because he didn't represent one of the seven major laboratories that were then involved. So he was very angry. As a matter of fact, years later, he wrote a book called The Rape of the Turin Shroud. Didn't sell many books. I suggested that it might have been the provocative title. But the point is, in that book, it's well documented what went down.
Yeah.
They should have listened to Meacham. He warned them. He tried to warn them that testing these kinds of samples was not always the best thing. And here's another point that rarely is brought up. Typically, when those kinds of samples are dated, it's only used in conjunction with a whole battery of other kinds of tests that were performed, and they use this as a verification.
Yeah.
Typically, if all the other tests are pointing in one direction and the C14 dating test points in a different direction, they throw away the C14 date because they know how easily skewed it is.
Yeah.
But in the case of the shroud, as soon as these results were announced, all the data from dozens, literally dozens of peer-reviewed journals was virtually cast off, thrown away. Nobody paid any attention to it anymore. And it's as if the C14 testing was the holy grail of science, which real scientists know it's not.
Exactly. I want to move to something real quick, and I'm gonna actually make an analogy here that I use all the time. Before I do that, because I want to cover the image itself, just a few of the things. Before I do that, I want to give out this number again, 678-963-5482, 678-963-5482.
This is a really controversial subject. It's probably one of the most controversial artifacts of all time. I know people have been asking me questions. They wonder about it. They have concerns about it. They have every reason to try and throw it out. If you have any questions or comments whatsoever, feel free to call. Barry is what I would consider to be a world-renowned expert, probably the top of the game in his field right now as far as the Shroud is concerned. So there's no better person to get on the phone and ask a question with. 678-963-5482. I give this analogy when I'm actually teaching about it. I ask if there's any artists in the crowd, because see, what the image is on the Shroud is actually a superficial image, and the best way that I can give a quick explanation as to what I mean by that is I ask some people, is there any artists in the crowd? And inevitably, there's always an artist in the crowd, and they raise their hand and say, okay, let me ask you a question. If I gave you a paintbrush that was only one horse hair, you know, not hundreds or thousands of horse hairs that make up a brush, but just one single strand, one horse hair. And then what I did was I told you, with that one horse hair, you can only paint the first two microfibers on the cloth, not threads. It's not the threads. There's many microfibers. There's many micro threads that are actually woven together to make a single thread. And correct. You can't, and we're not talking about the first two threads. We're talking about the first two microfibers of that thread. And
about
so what
two
I want
microns
you
microns in depth.
Yeah, 2 microns in depth. So what we want you to do is we want you to paint 2 microns in depth, which is inconceivable, just for the record, with one horsehair wide brush. And as a matter of fact, you can't do it up close with a magnifying glass, because the closer you get to the image, the more distorted it becomes. It kind of disappears. You actually have to step back.
It's just not visible.
Well, it's not visible. You have to step back, you know, a good 5 to 10 feet in order to do that. So I'm going to give you one horsehair brush, and I'm going to connect it to a 10-foot pole, and then you've got to only paint the first 2 microns of the fabric. And you can't use any pigments, dyes, or oils, or inks of any sort. Because there's none on the clock. Could you do it? And inevitably, I kind of get a chuckle across the crowd. And so that's, I wanted to establish the nature of the image, that it's a superficial image. The image itself. And what I want you to talk about first, and we really got to cover some quick ground here, Barry. So I'm going to be firing some questions at you. We got about 27 minutes left. What I want you to talk about is that time when they were about to uncover the back of the cloth, because for the first time, and how long, Barry, was it that they were actually going to look at the back of it to see whether or not the image went all the way through?
That was the first time in 400 years.
400 years, and what they discovered when they pulled, there was a protective cloth that was actually sewed onto the back to give the material a little bit of rigidity when they were holding it. Dealing with it to try and protect it.
That was actually sewn on after the 1532 fire, along with patches to cover all the 30 holes, and that was done to add stability to the cloth.
And so when they took it off, you were actually standing there, and I remember you telling me the story about when you were standing behind it and you were waiting to see, and you said, wait a second. And it's become one of the most famous pictures of the research. And tell me about what happened right at that moment.
Well, basically at that moment, as they were separating the shroud from the Hollander backing cloth, I recognized at that moment, we're about to see the backside for the first time since 1532 or 1534, and this was 1978, so I went running around to the other side to capture the expressions on the faces of the men as they separated this and they picked it up to look underneath, and that photograph captures the precise moment of the first look at the backside of the shroud in 400 plus years,
which is one of the turning points in the research on the shroud to see that it didn't actually penetrate through, and
correct.
The further research showed that the image is actually superficial image. Tell me about I want to, if we can cover two basic things in the next 20 minutes or so. Once again, the number is 678-963-5482. If you have any questions or comments, get on Facebook, What Is Truth Radio Show with Dave Glander, and just post your comments right there online as well. Barry, when you first walked around the corner and there was the shroud, you said something to me that has stuck with me since our first conversation. And you looked at it and you said, it's a fake. Why did you say that?
Well, one of the first things that struck me, and of course I always believed it was a fake in the early days before we ever got to see it, and one of the first things I noticed on the cloth when we got there, and I was speaking with Vern Miller, who was the chief scientific photographer, a dear friend, I noticed that the blood stains on the shroud were still red. And Vern, who had more forensic experience than I did, both of us agreed that old blood's supposed to turn black or brown. Why is this blood still red? And to me, that was a deal breaker. Yeah. And so I felt that because of that, they didn't really look like they might be legitimate bloodstains, even though chemistry eventually proved they were. But at that moment in time, this was, what, 15 minutes into our examination of 5 days. So at that point in time, I thought, well, you know, I must have been right, even though there isn't paint. I knew it wasn't a painting within an hour, but I wasn't satisfied because of those bloodstains. And I thought, you know, although I know it's not a painting and all that other stuff, I'm still not convinced of its authenticity because why is the blood still red?
And so then, if I remember right, you actually spent quite a bit of time believing that this was not the authentic burial shroud. Even though all the scientific research was starting to point to the authenticity of it, you still didn't believe it because of that until you got a phone call from, was it Adler?
Al Adler.
Al Adler gave you a call.
And that was 18 years later in 1995. And I was talking to Al, who was our blood expert, and it's funny, and I just wrote this recently on the website, that I'm not sure why I didn't ask him earlier. He was the man, and yet I never thought to ask him about it. And in that conversation, the subject of the red blood came up, and he explained to me that men who are tortured, not given any water, go into anaphylactic shock and traumatic shock, and the red blood cells, after an extended period of time, say 12, 14, 18, 20 hours of torture, the red blood cell walls start to break down. The liver floods the bloodstream with an enzyme called bilirubin, and blood that's had that happen to it will stay red forever.
How about that? So after all, the blood actually has a very, very good reason for being
red.
How about that? That is absolutely amazing.
And it only took 18 years to get an answer to that question.
What happened when you heard that, though? What went through your mind?
I'm not sure how long after the conversation before it came to me that was it. There were no things left for me to argue about.
How about that?
And the only conclusion I could then draw, and I always quote Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes, who once said in one of the stories, if you eliminate all the possibilities, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, is most likely the truth.
Yeah.
And based on that axiom, I was forced to conclude that I had just accepted the shroud as authentic. There was nothing left to argue against.
Absolutely. Once again, that number 678-963-5482. Brian Lawrence, was it Brian Lawrence on there? Brian Lawrence actually asked a question through Facebook. Is the shroud currently being kept in a secure location?
Absolutely. It is kept in a special cabinet in the Turin Cathedral, in the heart of Turin, the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. It is now kept flat and away from light in a nitrogen-argon atmosphere with temperature and humidity controls. It's probably the best preserved now than it has been in its entire history.
That was Brian Lawrence Mason. Sorry about that.
Good question, Brian.
That was a fantastic question. Let me ask you about something that I know. Was it John Jackson who was the NASA scientist?
Well, actually, he was NASA. The guys on our team that were from NASA were our imaging guys. They were from Jet Propulsion Labs, Don Lynn and Jean Lohr.
Okay.
Jackson, Jumper were both Air Force physicists teaching at the Air Force Academy. One was in thermodynamics and one in, I don't even remember what Jumper was involved with, but both of them were physicists, and they were the co-founders of the STRP team. They were the guys who decided that let's try and figure out how this image was formed, began to put together a team, and ultimately STRP, our team, the Shroud of Turin Research Project, was the result.
Well, tell me about why in the world would any of them had taken that image and put it into a VP8 analyzer?
Right, that sort of was the catalyst. The VP8 image analyzer was a very simple old analog device. The input was a black and white video camera, and it had a green screen raster display, kind of more like an oscilloscope than a TV set. And basically all it did was it took the lights and darks of the image as it was input with the black and white video camera, and it turned them into vertical relief. It stretched them vertically.
What was the original purpose of it?
It was at Sandia Laboratories, and they were using it actually to analyze x-rays. And, you know, x-rays sometimes of things like metal are very subtle, and the differences are so subtle, they were looking for a way of enhancing these x-ray images to extract more information from them. So somebody got the idea, let's put a shroud image in here and see what happens. So, because they already knew that if you put a normal photo in there, you just got a jumble of shapes and, yeah, you still get vertical relief, but it didn't form anything coherent. when they put the shroud image in and cranked up the dial on the gain, they get the perfect relief of a human form.
Wow.
Indicating that the density of the, or darkness of the image on the shroud was directly proportionate to the distance between the cloth and the body when the image was formed. In other words, where there was direct contact, tip of the nose, top of the hands, the image is darkest. As the distance increased, the image grows more faint up to about 4 centimeters where the imaging stops. Because of that, it encoded topographical information of this body, or spatial information, which we typically refer to as 3D, although that's kind of a misnomer.
Yeah.
But that's what the general public understands. And we have this dimensional information encoded in the image. You can't do that with photography. You certainly can't do that with painting. So that'll, you know, that's another critical facet of the shroud's image that belies the fact can't be a painting, can't be a photograph, because you can't do that with photography or painting.
And if that was some sort of medieval forgery, obviously they didn't have that kind of technology.
No, they didn't have that knowledge. And, you know, the image itself on the shroud is light, dark, reverse from what we normally see.
That's a good, that's a perfect segue, because you are a professional photographer.
That is correct.
And as such, you know that there is no such thing as the conceptualizing of a negative image until the late 1800s, when Secundo Pia took a picture of it.
Well, actually, the invention of photography is credited to the year 1818, when a man named Nietzsche Nietzsche made the first photographic negative plate and made a photograph of his garden. And that negative still exists.
Yeah.
Photography is an invention of the Industrial Revolution. It wasn't perfected and popularized until much later into the 1800s, of course. By the 1860s, we have Matthew Brady making all his beautiful Civil War photographs.
Sure.
And by then, photography had become a form of its own, but in the early 1800s was when it began. And so the idea that someone in medieval times could conceive of this, let alone create something using that, it's ludicrous.
It's ludicrous. It really is. We actually have a caller on the line with us. Caller, are you in there?
I'm here.
Hey, what's your name?
Well, my name is Steve Schwartz, but I spell mine with an A in the middle middle of the last
hi,
name. But hi,
Steve.
Shalom. I'm also Jewish, but I am a Messianic Jew, and I have a question for you. It's not a scientific one.
That's right.
But it's more biblical. The objection that I hear most often to the authenticity of the shroud comes from people who say that a Jewish man at that era would not have shoulder-length hair.
I really don't know how
to answer that.
Well, the answer is really simple. First of all, shoulder length, it was, I'm not sure it's shoulder length. It was sort of in a ponytail the way mine is, actually. that is totally incorrect. I know there's one gospel passage, I think, that talks about hair. But the Essenes were known to have long hair, and many other first-century Jews had long hair. You know, there's a question about that and the beard, because another objection similar to that one, Steve, is the plucking of the beard. It talks about that in the gospel. And I always tell people, well, they didn't give him a shave. They pulled out a few beard hairs. And trust me, I have a beard. If you pull one hair, you get tears in your eyes. It's painful. And so those are the kind of objections, I think, that are raised that sort of cast away all the other evidence because they're looking for some reason not to want to believe in the shroud. Trust me, and I think it's on our site on the frequently asked questions. You can get more details by a biblical expert that answers that way better than I can. That's not my forte.
I will go there and check it out.
Trust me that there were first century Jews with long hair, that it was not forbidden for Jews to have long hair. And, I mean, look at Jews today. I mean, look at the Hasidic Jews in New York. There isn't a short haircut amongst any of them.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, thank you for your question. Do you have any other comments or questions?
Not right now, but no? I'm going to keep listening. I'm enjoying the program.
Very good. Thank you so much
for
calling.
Okay.
If you have any questions or comments, just call 678-963-5482. Once again, that's 678-963-5482. Barry, I want to go back to that, the fact that it's a negative image. I don't think people really understand what that means. As a photographer, what that means is when you take a picture, when you first walk up to the shroud, you see it, and I'll be honest with you, it's really not all that impressive.
It's pretty subtle.
It's very subtle.
It's only 10% darker than the background.
Yes, and so what happens? In 1978, you were still using blackroom, darkroom. We didn't have printers and computers and all this stuff.
Right.
So what happened to the image when you took the picture? And of course, you already knew this was going to happen because of the photographs that had been taken.
And in 1931, it was photographed by Giuseppe Henriette.
Yeah. So what happens when you take a picture of the shroud, which is a very unimpressive image to begin with? What happens to it?
Okay, well, let me explain quickly that when we look at a photograph, let's just assume it's a monochromatic or black and white photo. We're used to seeing white highlights and dark shadows. That's sort of, you know, the natural thing, rendition of what we see. So the shroud is inverse of that, that what would be a highlight is dark and what would be a shadow is light. And when you photograph that and look at the negative, which inverts that again, now suddenly you have a natural positive image where the highlights are light and the shadows are dark.
Uh-huh.
So the image on the shroud itself is negative, and the resulting photographs made of it are positives. Now, tell me how a medieval guy would have figured that one out. Because if he painted it, he had to paint what we would perceive as a negative. I mean,
which was impossible to conceptualize,
yeah,
because
conceptualize
at this point photography hadn't been invented, which means nobody had seen a negative image. They didn't know that was even something that was possible, if you will.
Exactly. Exactly. I think you just summed it all up perfectly, Dave.
That blows me away. So far we've discovered that it's a superficial image that has three-dimensional qualities, that is covered in historical artwork throughout the centuries, that the carbon dating's been rendered inadmissible. There's actual blood on there.
Absolutely.
And it's actually a photographic negative.
And here's the other interesting thing about the blood. It's only on the cloth by direct contact. So forensic experts can look at it and see if these natural blood flows or did somebody paint them on. They're natural blood flows. And even more interesting is the fact that wherever there's blood on the shroud, which we know got on the cloth by contact with the body, wherever there's blood, there's no image. The blood and serum inhibited the image formation process.
Wow.
So if an artist was going to do it, he would first have to get the blood on the cloth correct forensic positions. And what, paint the image around it?
Why do you?
That's pretty funny.
Some of the theories out there have really made me crack up. I mean, because there's really good science out there, and I know it disrupts a lot of people's worldviews if it indeed is. I mean, there's a lot of people.
It even disrupted mine for a while.
Yeah, I mean, seriously. I mean, there's good reason why this would disrupt. So I could see why people try and latch on to anything there is at all. Why? Let me ask you this. And of course, this isn't a faith question. This is still scientific or historical in nature. But why do you think it was Jesus's cloth? Why couldn't it have been some other random dude?
Good question, Dave. I see why they've got you on the radio. No, look, here's the thing. And I get that question frequently. And think about it. There's only one man in documented history that had a specific set of tortures applied. Now, look, the Romans scourged people every day. They crucified people every day. They even speared them in the side every day. There's only one man in documented history that we're aware of that proclaimed himself king of the Jews, so they smashed this thorn bush onto his head. They called it a crown, but no soldier was asked to weave a pretty little crown. They smashed a bush of sharp thorns onto his head to humiliate him, and there's bloodstains all over the top of the head of this man. Who else could it be? Who else could it be? There's only one man that had that set of tortures applied.
So I mean, it. I guess what you're saying is the search for who it could have been is significantly narrowed down when we actually look at the gospel accounts of what Jesus went through. What about? I've heard Gary actually reference the fact that it's his legs weren't broken and there's a spear wound.
That's right.
Was that not common? I just heard you say that there was.
Well, they might have speared other men in the days, but typically if they were trying to hasten the death, they would break the legs, and that would make it more trauma, and the person would generally die quicker. According to the Gospels, they speared him, and he was already dead. There was no need to break the legs to hasten death because he was already gone. And so, and also, it does say in the Gospels, not a bone was broken.
Yeah.
And interestingly, if you look at the crucifixion wounds in the hands, they don't go through the center of the palm. They go through the, you know, the fleshy part towards the wrist.
Yeah.
If you put your thumb and your little finger together, it makes a groove down the middle of your palm called the thenar furrow. And a Roman soldier would have known to do that and use that groove and stick the nail in between the two fleshy parts, drive it in at a slight angle. It goes between bones in the wrist, and you're not going to be able to pull your hand loose. Remember, Jesus was a carpenter or builder. He was a strong man. And look, if somebody's torturing you like this and they're nailing you to a cross, if you can rip your hand loose, you will.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's...
so the exit wounds that we see on the back of the wrist of the man of the shroud, unlike all the Christian art that's been done through the centuries, shows the exit wounds in a forensically more accurate position than any Christian art does.
Yeah.
The problem is, in Greek or in Aramaic or even in Latin, the difference between palm and the fleshy part of the palm, there is no distinction. So when they say hand, a lot of people think, well, it's got to be in the middle of the palm. That seems to be logical, accurately, you know, the Romans did this all the time. They knew
experts.
Exactly how.
They were experts. You know, I found most interesting is that part you're talking about, I believe, is called the space of Destot.
Oh, the space of Destot. That's the space where the wound, where the nail would have gone through without breaking any bones.
And interestingly enough, the image of the man on the shroud has no thumbs. And if you take your hand right now and you kind of put it face up and you take your thumb and you press right on that space, right where your palm meets your arm, and that's that space right there is called the space of Destot. Your median nerve runs right through there, and as the nail would have penetrated the space of Destot, it most likely would have sliced that median nerve. And
either
if you press right there,
look, it's a nerve. All you got to do is touch it and cause a reaction.
And what it did was it actually caused the thumbs to collapse inside of itself. Barry, we have kind of a personal question, and then and then we're gonna have to go. One of our viewers on Facebook has asked a question. Does he believe that the shroud was a result of Jesus' resurrection?
Ah, good question. Let me answer it by saying this. First of all, if we're going to talk about faith, then we can talk about resurrection, because resurrection is not a scientific term. Scientists cannot go into a laboratory and resurrect people to see what kind of images we can make.
Don't tell them that, Barry. I'm just kidding.
No, they think tell the truth.
I know. I'm just playing around.
So here's
there.
The point that, look, obviously, because the Christian faith, the whole purpose, the whole foundation of the Christian faith is the resurrection, I can say, even from my perspective, that I don't have any problem with Christians sort of extrapolating all this information, saying science can't explain it, we can't even characterize or duplicate this image, so this must be proof of something miraculous, perhaps the resurrection. I don't argue the point. It could be. I wouldn't argue that.
Yeah.
But from a scientific point of view, I have to stay clear that, first of all, we can never prove who the man is scientifically, and secondly,
sure,
whether or not this is proof of the resurrection is really up to the individual.
Yes.
And here's the kind of the final thought. People often say, so what does it all mean? And I point to this cloth and I say, look, the answer is not on the cloth. It didn't come with the book of instructions. The answer is always going to be in the eye and the heart of the beholder.
Yes.
Each of us has to reach that conclusion on our own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What can you answer in about 2 minutes? A couple of weeks ago, a team of Italian scientists I was curious as, because I know that you actually pertain to a vapor theory. I myself pertain to more of an X-ray radiation theory. That's we agree on I think 99% of the shroud, but I actually part ways with you on that. Maybe that's because in my worldview I'm looking for some miraculous, you know, not of illumination sort of thing. And
trust me, that if it were vaporograph or it's, and actually that's not really what he said, but that's part of what he said. But if that were true, that would be just as miraculous in my mind,
sure,
as radiation. The only difference is radiation has certain impact on linen fibers, and we would find traces of that in impacting the fibers. That's not there.
What did they find recently?
This is the ironic part of that recent news blurst, was that they were referencing an article that was published in May of 2010. It took a year and a half for that to become news. The good news is it came out just before Christmas, so I see it as a Christmas present for my Christian brothers and sisters. If you want a detailed response to that, I wrote an editorial that's currently on shroud.com. You can find it there,
okay,
where I spent five pages answering specifically what the claims were, they were valid, but it was so blown out of proportion by the media, I listed some headlines. Go read those headlines, and you'll see they're all reporting the same story, which started off being correct and accurate and wound up being Shroud proved to be Jesus.
Yeah.
None of which was in the original article.
Yeah.
So that editorial, I wrote it specifically to answer because I got hundreds of emails over the holidays
Let's go ahead and plug your website and your it's not a, do you call it a ministry or business?
Yeah, it's a nonprofit organization called Shroud of Turin Education and Research Association. That's the nonprofit I founded, gave over the website and all my photographic materials to preserve them. Something happens to me that they'll be able to continue going forward. The website is easy. It's shroud.com.
Well, that was complicated. You might want to repeat that one more time.
Sure. www.shroud.com. People often say, how did you get such a great domain name? And I said, it was available.
you opened that before domain names were getting sat on, squatted
on,
and sold for thousands.
Absolutely. 1995, I applied for it and immediately got it because it was available.
Absolutely. Well, Barry, we cannot thank you enough for your time today. You have been a real mentor to me in this search that I've gone through as far as trying to figure out the ins and outs, and I appreciate that.
Might I add that you've been a very good student, Dave.
Well, thank you very much, Barry. I appreciate that very, very much. Thank you, Barry. I'm gonna actually answer a question that was asked by a skeptic relative of mine, and this one's kind of the Christian answer, and we also kind of have one that's from a guy named Joe in Texas. Let me see that right there, Shannon. Just click off of that so I can read Joe's question. Joe in Texas said, after being convinced of the authenticity of the Shroud, have you concluded that Jesus was the actual person on it? We kind of dealt with that little bit.
Yeah, I think that it's the only plausible answer.
I think so, too. If not, why are you convinced? Why are you not convinced of the biblical account? Maybe that question was for you.
Oh, well,
I think you are convinced of the biblical account.
I am convinced of the biblical account of the crucifixion and the burial, because it was a first century Jewish burial, follows all the Jewish rules.
Absolutely. The skeptic friend of mine asked this, did I think that God, for some reason, integrated technology within this cloth so that at a day and time when the technological advances would come along, some 2,000 years later, that we would be able to test with electron microscopes and with photography and with DNA testing,
but
the blood
technology.
Analysis. They said, do you think that God encrypted that in there? If so, why? And my answer to that, if I may, is I think we're living at this time when, like I said, Barry, this is going to be my Christian perspective on this.
Well,
we live at this time when skeptics are trying to beat down Christianity on every front.
I understand.
God's trying to be removed. Evolution's trying to take. We just live at this time where as the Bible says, we've got the great apostasy coming, and we're starting to see that. And I think at a time like this where the skeptics are running rampant all over the Christian faith, there has actually been this research done on the Shroud that to me pokes holes in a lot of those theories out there.
It certainly does. And let me add this, although I certainly don't feel that I'm qualified to speak for God, think about this, that much of what we've learned about the Shroud couldn't have even been discovered even 50 years ago, let alone 400 or 700 or before. So I have no problem believing that perhaps the way the Shroud is made and its unique features are such that God knew that at some point in time man would perhaps reach a point, not perhaps, but knew we would reach a point where we could begin to discern what was there and see that this is in effect a testament of the passion of Jesus.
That's a great answer, Barry. One last thing. It looks like we've got just enough time to barely do that.
Sure.
And this may be a little bit confusing, but it's a little bit lengthy, but I'll read it and then we'll respond to it. Charlie Wolcott posted, I know enough about the Shroud to know that the theoretical significance, but it's not the Shroud of Christ's burial. The wrappings around his head were folded neatly. The rest of his burial clothes were collapsed as though the body went through them, but not the clothes over his face. This is how we get the etiquette tradition of folding the napkin to tell the waiter at the restaurant that we are not finished with your meal.
Let me quickly answer before we run out of time.
Okay.
Your friend is exactly right. There were two cloths. But remember, two cloths can be separate from each other tell your friend to look up Sudarium of Oviedo, which is the face cloth that would have been removed before the burial shroud was put on, and that was the cloth that was folded and set aside in the tomb because it had blood on it, and it had to be buried with the body. That's Jewish law.
Who set the cloth to the side?
Probably the disciples, as they began to prepare the body for burial. Remember, there wasn't time. The Sabbath was fast approaching. They had to set it aside.
Absolutely. Listen, Barry, thank you once again for coming on. This has been What is Truth Radio with Dave Glander. Come in next Sunday at 6 o'clock, and we're going to address more topics. We thank you for your listening. God bless you, and have a good day.